Thank you so much, Sarah, and thank you to everybody to listen to me. We were really introduced by Sarah, and just would like to reemphasize that the purpose of the lecture today is to discuss, to present to you one of the mission that was defined successful, the mission to ACHE, and also is timely to speak about ACHE again in addition to, because it's linked to what you had last week, but also because ACHE will soon have provincial elections and local elections in April. Also, given the recent political development, I would like, after ACHE, to bridge over to the Maldives. We all have read about what is happening there. I was lucky to work there as well for a couple of years. It sounds very exotic. Nevertheless, was very, very politically interested at the time. And there are some developments. So I'd like to also discuss, to put all those two missions in a contest. European Union contest, what is the European Union doing in these countries? Why the European is venturing outside the membership to mount missions and electoral missions and crisis management missions. So as a practitioner, I will give a very short context and then we'll move on how these missions are organized and what exactly we do in the field. So we'll start with crisis management missions, and just to give you a little bit of institutional framework, again, very briefly, as otherwise will be very lengthy and lecture that I would like to not to. This is the framework for the crisis management missions was created by the Maastricht Treaty in 1992, which established three pillars, and the second pillar in the European Security and Defense Policy is the framework that interests us, the framework for this crisis management mission of the European Union. And this is when the political union goal emerged after the treaty. But the current framework is the Treaty of Lisbon of 2007, entering into force in December 2009, amending both Rome and Maastricht Treaty and creating a new High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Mr. Catherine Ashton. Ms. Ashton is assisted by a new structure, the European External Action Service, which is the external arm of all European institutions. So is the body which performs the foreign activity of the European Union. So at that time, a new goal of political union was emerged strongly. The ESDP missions were renamed CSDP, Common Security and Defense Policy Mission, to reflect this goal of political unity. As a result of this treaty, the EU has now 136 representation abroad, headed by an ambassador, so there are political representation in the field of the European Union. The security strategy, though, emerged from the European Council of 12 December 2003. And this document has identified the pillars of EU operations, main pillars that were then further developed and interpreted as time and politics developed. Those pillars are, you can see them from the screen, terrorism, war, weapons of mass destruction, regional conflicts, prevention of state failures, and organized crime. So those are the pillars that emerged from the document. The real setup of the mission, of the European Union missions. This was translating in specific fields of operations, as you will see some examples, police reform, Bosnian Palestinian territory in Congo, security sector reform, in the DRC Congo, fight against organized crime, border control, rule of law, more and more is rule of law missions the EU is doing, fight against piracy, in the Horn of Africa and support to existing mission in Darfur. The The EU is proud to cooperate with other international organizations, as a joint declaration with the UN has identified four areas: planning, training, communication, and best practice. And there is an example of cooperation, as you would see in the example over there. And the EU also allows third state countries to participate in its own operations, as we will see in the mission to Aceh. Just to carry you through some of the first missions of the EU, we have Macedonia in 2003 with the mandate to contribute to a stable, secure environment, followed by Proxima in 2004 and 2005 with the mandate of rule of law and police reform. Both of these missions, there was cooperation with other organizations. And then latest missions, Kosovo, again, rule of law, 2008, EU Atalanta, Horn of Africa, to protect vessels of the WFP and help deter the threats out of piracy. And finally, Libya, EU for support of humanitarian assistance, the last one in 2011. And here is a list, just an overview of current missions and missions that already ended. You see there is Aceh there on the bottom right. The blue one has been completed, so it's quite an articulated environment with a number of missions. And the green one, especially those with darker green, are military missions. So there is approximately 24 missions worldwide, ranging from Balkans to Middle East and to Africa. But there is only one in Asia, as you will see there, and that's the one we're going to speak about. And the famous Aceh monitoring mission, the AMM. This is what was our logo. Just again, for the purpose of putting things in context, this is a fact sheet of Indonesia. It's important to understand what it all happened. It's an archipelago of more than 13,000 islands and islets, so quite fragmented, with five main islands: Sumatra, Java, Kalimantan, Sulawesi, and Irian Jaya, 33 provinces, majority of Muslim, 86%, with approximately, I think now there are more, 200 million inhabitants. So quite a fragmented scenario we have. And this is a map. You see the five different islands and islets, quite a big country, fragmented again, and in the northern tip of the island of Sumatra, there is the province of Aceh. So what happened in Aceh has put things again in a context historically and politically. 30 years conflict in Aceh with approximately 15,000 victims. So the conflict was between the government of Indonesia and the Free Aceh Movement group, the so-called the GAM. The issue was the independence of Aceh. Aceh has been a very proud sultanate since the 12th century. It's from Aceh that Islam entered into Indonesia. From Indian traders, Aceh was a marketplace, was very strong in trading, gold, ivory, timber, and spices. And therefore, it always considered itself as a world aside in Indonesia. So the conflict again brought a lot of casualties and obviously hampered development in the province. This was followed, unfortunately, by earthquake and tsunami. Earthquake very strong, 9.2 of the Richter scale, followed by tsunami on 26 December 2004. And this is the number of casualties you will see, almost 736 total casualties. So a very big number in addition to those killed by the conflict. So a very, very serious situation. The province was in its knees. They really needed peace and stability. So this was a very important window of opportunity for negotiation, for conclusion of negotiation, which started prior, but this was the final push for both sides to come to agreement. And the agreement was finally signed in Helsinki on the 15th of August 2005, brokered by Nobel Peace Prize, Martti Ahtisaari in 2008. On the two sides you see Indonesian government, Minister Awaludin, Minister of Justice, and the GAM, the rebel representative, Mr. Mohamed Malik, which finally signed the agreement on in 2005. We will go through the main points after that. It's important to understand now that with this agreement, the ASHRAE movement renounced the issue of independence. So they were not getting independence anymore, they were getting special autonomy within the unitary states of Indonesia. So we will see exactly what this meant. At this stage, it's important to see why the EU got involved into ASHRAE. ASHRAE is very far from the membership. There was never been a mission before. So why did the EU got involved into ASHRAE? Soon at the beginning of the negotiation, President Ahtisaari understood that there was a need for a credible monitoring mission into ASHRAE. So there was a need of an organization which had the structures to mount a mission into the province. The UN could not be considered. Why is that? We have seen the map of Indonesia. The UN was perceived as being involved into the East Timor referendum of 1999. So the East Timor referendum was undertaken under the auspices of the UN. And therefore, in order to avoid referring to independence and also to try to not to trigger other questions of independence within the archipelago, the UN was not considered as the best candidate for the job. So President Ahtisaari, in the middle of the negotiation, brought in the EU representative to observe the negotiation phases. And it was established that the EU would be the organization to undertake the monitoring. Nevertheless, the EU, as I said, was not regionally linked to Indonesia, to ASEAN, or to any of the Asian countries. So it lacked regional legitimacy. So in order to provide regional legitimacy to the mission, the Asian organization, Southeast Asian nations, was brought in to work together with the EU, again for the purpose of providing regional legitimacy to the mission. As we have seen, the EU cooperates with a lot of regional organizations in the field. And again, the EU was part of, the EU intervention was part of the MOU, but also was invited officially by both Indonesian and the GAM, the Indonesian government and the GAM. And this is one of the most important conditions for implementation of a mission. There must be an invitation from the country. And this is what we will see also in election observation. Now, again, what were the main points of the MOU? Self-government, there was special autonomy, but not independence. Independence was a word that we were never able to use while doing the monitoring. Another point was political participation. The actionists could establish the local political party. This is an issue that is still debatable in the local elections now, will still be an issue. But nevertheless, this was part of the MOU. Economic provision, ASHRAE was able to retain 70% of the revenues of natural resources. ASHRAE is rich on natural resources, therefore this was an issue of contention, of course. And also ASHRAE could fix its interest rate delinked from the Bank of Indonesia, which is quite a strong provision, and I understand it's quite also risky. Amnesty of GAM former prisoners, we have mentioned already that there was quite a blank provision, quite a strong provision, nevertheless quite contentious as we will see. Security arrangements, ceasefire, and the commissioning of arms and the mobilization of soldiers. And finally, the modalities of monitoring, already touched on that, EU, the EU mission mandate. What type of mission was it? Was EU-led, already said, integrated with the Asian to provide regional legitimacy? Was the first EU mission in Asia? We've seen in the map there was no other mission in Asia. Was a civilian mission with military expertise, as we will see from some of the photos after that, but nevertheless was essentially a civilian mission, and it was the first mission with human rights and reintegration components. I understand there is quite an interest here for human rights, and so this was the first mission. And as for myself, I was a deputy head of mission in charge of amnesty, human rights, reintegration, and legislation change. So I had quite a broad mandate at that time. Just to give a little bit of figures to understand how big was the mission, we started with 230, we reduced to 104, scaled down to 86, and finally 36 was the last group of us who stayed through the completion of the mission. We had one headquarter in Banda Aceh, the provincial town of Aceh, and 11 district offices. And you see the breakdown, European Union and Asian countries that were working alongside with us. And we go to the mission components. Again, there was a decommissioning of guns, arms, immobilization of combatants, and at the same time, redeployment of Indonesian troops, amnesty for gun prisoners, reintegration of former combatants, human rights, and monitoring of legislation change. Going one by one, decommissioning is basically collection of rebels' guns. They were collected, they were made into pieces, as you will see, completely destroyed, put it into boxes, and stored away. No longer there were guns in the country. They declared they had 840 guns. This is the number of guns they brought to us, with some negotiations still needed when we were there. They, at a certain point, they said we have no more guns, we didn't collect them all, so we couldn't go on. And then finally, all of a sudden, the other guns came out and we rounded to 840, miraculously. So this was one component. The other component was redeployment. Indonesian troops who were brought in into Aceh to for the rebellion were redeployed back to Indonesia. There was a high number, 25,000, if I remember correctly, that left Aceh. Those two components work in conjunction. So as guns were, arms were destroyed, Indonesian soldiers were returning to the mainland. And the ceasefire was, of course, staying holding. And then we have amnesty. Amnesty was really a very difficult endeavor. The EU had quite a broad mandate on that. In case of disagreement, we could rule on the amnesty cases. Nevertheless, we were very aware that this was a measure of last resort. So we wanted the two parties to decide on it. And we actually managed not to rule on that. As for figures, there were 1,080 people were released immediately upon the signature of the MOU. And shortly after, there were others that were released in smaller figures. But 116 cases remain disputed. And because the crime committed was not clear that was related to gang activity, because this was one of the conditions, amnesty could be granted for gang-related crimes. So those cases were not clearly affiliated and required quite a lot of negotiation to be solved. And after AMM, the mission negotiation, all the gang prisoners were amnestied at the end. And this again, we had a discussion before whether it was right or not, whether it affected international law or not. It served political purpose. So it really was instrumental to maintain the peace in the country. And then we had reintegration packages. We see a former combatant to former combatant. that were integrated into normal life. So they had short-term measures like package handouts of money and basic items, and also some long-term provisions like work, employment, welfare, and allocation of land. And this program that was supposed to be carried on for 3 years. So it did not finish completed with the mission, but it was a 3 years program to reintegrate combatants and civilians affected by the conflict into life. And then we had human rights. This is the first mission with a human rights component. Therefore, the negotiation on this component was quite tough. At the end, it was decided that this mandate would be confined, defining time and scope, time with violation that will occur after the signature of the memorandum, not before. We were not there to look at what happened in the past, otherwise we would have never reached any peace or maintained peace. So only violations that occur after that, and also violations as well are related to the MOU commitments. So the human rights mandate was not had some constraints again in time and scopes. The scenario was not too worrisome. There were four serious cases of killing of GAM soldiers, one rape, and the rest we had some intimidation, extortion, and assault, which was very much expected in a situation in a country that had 30 years of conflict. And then we had legislation change. There was a new law enacted from Indonesian parliament on the governance of Aceh, of the province of Aceh. On that we did a monitoring only. Obviously we didn't have a very wide mandate. This was a sovereign parliament which enacted a new law for the province, governing of the province of Aceh. Just a little bit on operational activities. This is a photo of our meetings with the two parties, just to give you an idea of what we do in the field. If you see in the photo, we have us sitting there, head of mission in the center, two other deputies, myself on the left-hand side, and here on the right, on the far left, we have the representative of the Indonesian government. On the other side, on the right-hand side, is the representative of the GAM rebel group. So those are meetings we were holding every 15 days, sometimes more if it was required, and all the major problems were discussed and the decisions were taken. An example could be, again, the amnesty cases were decided. Sometimes I had to have separate meetings with both parties to discuss before having plenary, where the discussion on the reintegration packages, when to distribute the funding to the combatants, and on the decommissioning, where all these guns that were missing. So those are the kind of meetings we are having, and decisions were taken right there. And these were called Commission on Security Arrangement, COSA, that's the way we call it. And this is a setup of those meetings, GAM on one side, Government of Indonesia on the other side, and head of mission and deputy head of missions on the center of the table. Now, we move to why the Aceh mission was a success. So just like to highlight some of the major points that caused the Aceh mission to be considered a successful mission. First of all, there was a commitment from Indonesian leadership. No mission can be successful if there is no commitment from the parties. So both Indonesian leaders, President Yudhoyono and his vice, Yusuf Kalla, elected in 2004, were committed to that. And also there was a GAM political will also to come to an agreement. But even more so, there was a plight of the population to a peace of prosperity. After conflict and tsunami, it was time for peace. And perhaps they saw that those events, tsunami really ravaging the country, was the last chance for peace. In addition to that, there was a comprehensive package deal agreed during the negotiation. So there was not only ceasefire that we were monitoring, but there was a comprehensive package of decisions and also incentive and peace dividends provided, including already in the MOU. So the population was seeing, reading that there were peace dividends coming immediately after the agreement. But also there was other factors were the prompt deployment of the mission. Early September 2005, we were already there. So after a couple of weeks from the signature of the MOU, the mission was mounted promptly and arrived in the country. So there was no time in between. And also the EU had substantial decision-making power. The EU could investigate and rule on violation of the MOU and on disputed amnesty cases, as I mentioned. And also our monitoring was proactive. We are setting priorities, having meetings with the party, calling all the parties, and we were always keeping the parties focused on issues and deadlines through the so-called COSA meetings, as we have seen. Also, and most importantly, Liberato's timelines of operations agreed. So we knew exactly the length of the mission. There were a couple of extensions on the mission, but it was not an open-ended operation, with exception of the reintegration program, which I mentioned was lasted for three years. And finally, there was a clear end of state of the old peace process. There was the organization of provincial elections, which happened in 2006. These elections were certified as legitimate, as we will see when we speak about elections. And those elections brought to power a former GAM rebel, who was in prison. Yusuf Irwandi is now the governor of the province of Aceh. So this is as much as I go for the mission of Aceh, and I'd like to link it to election observation, which is another important activity that the EU is doing at the moment. And again, from there we will see what the EU has done for the mission, for the election in Aceh, but even more so, I'd like to speak a little bit about the Maldives, given the recent political situation. So we start with the definition. Definition comes from Declaration of Principle for International Election Observation, signed at the UN in 2005. This is the latest important definition because it includes main players in election observation, including the EU, the OSCE. All main players in the field of election observation have signed the declaration that describe election observation as a systematic, comprehensive, and accurate gathering of information concerning the law, process, and institutions related to the conduct of elections and other factors concerning the overall electoral environment. Also, the impartial and professional analysis of such information and the drawing of conclusion about the character of electoral processes based on the highest standard of accuracy in information and impartiality of analysis. So immediately from these definitions, we can see what are the principles of election observation. First of all, neutrality and impartiality. There cannot be observation of elections there must be an impartial and neutral organization. So there must be seen and perceived as an impartial intervention of observers. Also, there must be non-interference with internal affairs of the state. This is a common principle of the UN Charter. It applies to election observation. So non-interference with affairs, internal affairs of the state, but also important to see is the highest standard of accuracy of information. So the professionalism of the information that we collect, analyze, and report. The previous legal framework that has been others, but the main one, it was the General Assembly Resolution on 1991, enhancing the effectiveness and the principle of periodic and genuine elections. Those two and the following one, number 27, those two have really defined election observation before and set adopt the conditions for implementation of an observation mission. And those two resolutions define observation as the act of observing an electoral process and reporting on the findings without interfering with the process itself. Supervising is the process of certifying the validity of all or some of the steps in the electoral process and supervising aspect of it. So supervision is more somehow intrusive mandate than observation. This was used for elections in Bosnia, where the OSCE had supervisor. We were certifying the elections. We are signing the forms at the polling station level, whereas with observation, there is no interference. The observers are not interfering. They are not stopping the process. They are not questioning. They are just reporting. Also defining monitoring as a wider act of observing with some intervention problem. We have seen the ACE monitoring mission. There was a monitoring mission. And finally, there is technical assistance. This is the one that we did in the Maldives, the act of providing technical support to the electoral process. For example, review of an electoral law. So the experts serve as part of as consultant, as technical expert for the election commission to work on the electoral laws or to work on all the different steps of the electoral process. And again, what are the conditions for implementation of an observation mission? First of all, there must be an invitation and agreement with the recipient countries. Observers are not just going, they are an observers if they are not invited by the government. As we have seen also for the mission to ACE, the mission was invited by both the government and the gang rebels. There must be the support of stakeholders and political parties, so the political party must agree, must be seeing the welcome the mission, the observation mission. And there must be an agreement on withdrawal of observers in case of security problem, in case the elections do not turn out the way they are supposed to be. There must be also adequate lead time prior to the election. So if there is not enough time for a mission to be mounted, a mission cannot be implemented. They need to recruit, they need to train observers. So there must be enough time to do that. Also, there must be an adequate legal framework already in place, so which will bring to a significant election. So otherwise, an observation mission would not be effective. And of course, and perhaps most importantly, there must be a condition of safety for observers. Observers must be able to operate in a safe environment. This is not always the case, but sometimes can turn a little risky, but nevertheless, there must be minimum conditions for working. And this is the purpose. Why do we do observation? First of all, is legitimacy, to build a consensus on the legitimacy of the electoral process. This recognition, to increase chances of recognition by international community, would bring confidence building. We express international community interest and support, deterrence, deter the possibility of irregularities and problem solving. Although we're not interfering, we identify difficulties of the electoral process and we bring it to the attention of the relevant authorities. This is just a photo of observing elections in Armenia in 2003. What is the main output of observation? We have seen we're not interfering, try to be professional, we gather information with maximum accuracy, but what exactly is the final output of observation? Is reporting. So the observers, at the end of their mission, they issue a report, which is usually brought to the attention to the government where the observation was taking place. And I'm going to show you briefly, before we speak about Maldives, some example of reports that observers have issued. The first one was Indonesian presidential elections, 1999, elections of elected President Megawati. Conduct of elections was sufficiently free and transparent. You have seen, read this, free and fair elections. This was used at that time. Now it is considered a little bit too vague. exactly, it is used more legitimate, transparent, but at that time was free and fair. This was the slogan that was used. In Peru in 2001, Toledo elections, Toledo won the elections. The elections were compliant with international standards. Obviously, these are extracts. The reports are much more longer and articulated than that, just to give you an idea. We're not writing just one line. And then was Sri Lanka, speaking about safety of observers. This was a very, very violent election. Nevertheless, opposition party secured quite a few seats, and the extract of this report was the result of elections reflects the will of the people who clearly wanted change. So the observer certified that although there was some violence and some irregularities, the election reflected the will of the people that expressed their will to change the present setup. And then we have some Slovakia, Armenia, and Ukraine. I'm going to go quickly through that, otherwise we'll rush, we'll finish the time. Am I too late already?
No, 5 minutes or so.
Okay. So this is also an OSCE endeavor. OSCE is also doing election observation in member states, so you can put more stringent conditions to that. And going back to Indonesia again, these elections represented a culminating event that firmly consolidated the democratic reform process in Indonesia. So we have seen the first democratic elections in 1999. The following one, 2004, was the one that really consolidated democracy. So the road to democracy is long. It's not only one event, it's not only one election that brings democracy to a country. We see, speaking about Maldives, that there's been in 2008 a very important step forward, but nevertheless, the road to democracy is quite long and it takes different steps. And local election in Aceh in 2006, historic elections, formal culmination of the Aceh peace process, they show the commitment of the people of Aceh to consolidating and strengthening the democratic process. So, end of state of the Aceh Monitoring Mission organization of local elections, which were observed and considered consolidating the democratic process. Finally, my last endeavor was Liberia. I returned in December from Liberia, where we had a very good election, nevertheless boycotted by the opposition party. Another peace process laureate, Ms. Johnson Sirleaf, re-elected in elections, and observation proved to as witness the elections and qualified by all observation mission, national and international, as credible and transparent. So we were judged as a very good elections, and Ms. Johnson Sirleaf re-elected as Liberian president. Now, a little bit of what the EU is doing on this field, just to connect with the Aceh Monitoring Mission. The EU is doing electoral assistance and election observation, both. We have seen electoral assistance as a technical assistance to the election process. Election observation is information gathering and reporting on the election. So the EU is doing both, both a kind of operations. And just to give a little bit chronology of EU observation missions, the first EU election observation mission was in 1993 in the Russian Federation, followed by South Africa. Again, here the EU was invited sort of in partnership and also in addition of the UN, because the UN was perceived as having worked with the ANC and therefore not necessarily perceived as neutral. And I stress again, perceived. Same happened in 1996 in the Palestinian elections. Here again, the EU was invited because of the UN involvement with the PLO. So this is the first missions. After that, since 2000, approximately 50 missions were undertaken worldwide by the EU. So it's quite a big effort of the EU in elections. And there's a very, very detailed methodology officialized by the European Union. So that's why European Union is becoming stronger and stronger in election observation, because it also has a very detailed methodology in doing the missions. And we move now to Maldives, 5 minutes for that. This is a photo of beautiful islands of Maldives. Nevertheless, the Maldives is not a beautiful archipelago of many islands, but also has gone through a lot of political turmoil. Just to give you a little bit of details, to understand also which we are talking about, a fragmented geographically country, 1,119 coral islands divided into 21 atolls, including the capital of Male. Approximately only 200 are inhabited. So 72 have less than 500 inhabitants. So population is very scattered, and there are 6 islands that have less than 100 people. So the reason why I'm giving you these details, just to show you how complicated an election is there, because even if you have 6 people far away in one island, you have to go reach them. And 88 of these islands are holiday resorts. So their management, their administration is under the company that rents the island. In total, we have 300,000 people only. Tourism is prominent, accounted every year to the double of the population. So you can see it's quite a significant impact on the country. And there is lack of public transportation, so it's impossible to have public transportation, public boats that go around the islands. So it's all left to private hiring of boats, which is costly and complicated. And also as a problem of global warming, I'm sure all of you have read that in the next few years, most probably the beautiful islands will be under the sea. So the country is, the government is very much aware of it. And it's an issue of survival of the state. And politically, just to give you a background, there's been the same presidency for 30 years, 1978-2008. So President Gayoom served for 6 consecutive years. So this is quite a long period to be in power. But after before the 2008 elections, the constitution was totally revised. With international assistance as part of the reform agenda. And in 2008, we had the first quote-unquote democratic election, and main opposition leader was elected. We have all read a recent political turmoil, elected President Nasheed resigned, and the situation is currently under investigation, with some countries backing the possibility of early elections, which were due next year in October, according to the normal schedule. So again, to explain a little bit what we do in the field, in the Maldives, before 2008, there was the EU providing technical assistance to the country. And I was lucky enough to be heading a team on technical assistance into drafting election legislation. The election law needed to be completely redone, like the constitution. Basically, it was completely redone, and the EU provided expertise for those laws to be redone. And 5 laws were enacted, as you see the list there. In addition, we issued the Election Commission issued 3 regulations, presidential, parliamentary, and political parties regulation, and 6 code of conduct for parties, media, observers, candidates, agents. All the stakeholders who got a code of conduct. In addition to that, this was basically, just to put things in a time frame, 1.5 years work of team of experts. In addition to that, with this assistance to all phases of the electoral cycle, particular plan and logistics, we have seen how fragmented is the country, how complicated it is to do the logistics in that country. Dedicated assistance was given in voter education, how to educate the Maldivians to elections. This is again was supposed to be the first democratic election, so that the population needed to be educated on that. On training of poll workers, and also, and most importantly perhaps, at the end was the complaints and appeal process. And also final assistance in the organization of legitimate elections, which we guaranteed to the two rounds of presidential elections and then parliamentary elections. And this is the report that the Commonwealth was there to observe, as we were there to do the technical assistance. There were other organizations who did the observation and said that the process was credible overall and met many of the benchmarks for democratic election to which Maldives has committed itself. High level of transparency, inclusiveness, and determination in interest of the electorate to participate in such large number, the turnout was quite high, stood out as a positive feature. Nevertheless, issues related to the process of voter registration and compilation of the voter list urgently need to be addressed. So, like most missions, they are never perfect. So there are still issues that need to be worked on. Registration was one. It didn't function very well. The country had to redo completely the voter registration, again, due to the fact that the logistic and the geography of the country is quite complicated. And I think my time is over. I guess there will be some questions. This is a photo of parliamentary elections in Mauritania. Quite nice. And anyway, we'll leave you here with a photo of Aceh. This is not Maldives. Never, believe it or not, this is Aceh. A nice speech as well. Thank you very much for listening. If there is any question, I'll be happy to answer. And thank you again.